This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Get up, stand up.
Stand up for your rights. Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I have in the studio with me today two gentlemen from Common Ground, Oregon, Washington. I have Jeff Strange, who's the chair of the board?
Chair of the membership.
Chair of the membership. Okay, well, we'll have to get into that, kind of how that works. And Jeff Smith, who's the outreach director. Welcome, both of you gentlemen, to the studio.
Thank you. Good morning.
And so, as I was saying just before we went on the air, this is probably not the most sexy conversation to have at 8 a.m. in the morning, but clearly we're all concerned about taxes here in Oregon and how our tax system is not supporting what we as a community believe is the common good. So I want to start, Jeff Strand, with asking you, what is Common Ground, Oregon, Washington?
Common Ground, Oregon, Washington is a chapter of Common Ground, USA, and more information can be found at commonground-usa.net. But it's Common Ground USA is a national 501c4 organization that's organized to basically shift taxes towards private use of natural resources and away from taxes on labor and capital. So basically what we want to see is a shift of taxes towards things we don't want to see, which is private exploitation of nature, and away from things we do want to see, which is people taking home their rightful pay or the use of capital to make improvements.
Okay. And so there's a national organization, there's local chapter, and you chair the Oregon-Washington chapter?
That's right. We have an Oregon-Washington chapter, and most of our members are in Oregon, and so we're mainly working on Oregon legislation rather than Washington legislation at this time. We only have one member in Washington.
Okay. And so is most of your work focused on legislative changes?
That's right. Yeah, we're working on legislation. And in the past, there have been more members in Washington, and at that time, they worked more on Washington legislation. But at this point, we have more members in Oregon, so we're working on Oregon legislation.
Okay. And so, Jeff Smith, you have a slate of legislation in this current legislative session. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the categories, because I see they're broken down in categories. And so, property tax shift. Mm-hmm. Is the first group. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and also I might toss in that actually I christened this group when it got started, Common Ground, a decade ago. But the idea is this. Right now the property tax, it falls on both the improvement and the location, on the building and the land, but that is counterproductive. It'd be more efficient economically if that tax fell only on the land. Because if you were speculating, you'd have to pay for withholding valuable sites from use. And if you were to make improvements under the current system, you would increase your tax liability. So that discourages people from doing that. And you end up with, at the margin, buildings not maintained as well as they would be otherwise. And you can see this happen in places where they do the property tax shift. And where they take it off the building, you see improvements happen. And where they put it on the land, you see inner city development, which is something most of us would want. You get a more efficient city. You create jobs when the construction happens. You attract investment. You shorten trip distances and many other benefits spin off from that property tax shift.
Are there communities that currently have this property tax system in place now?
There are, and they don't have it in a big way. But what happens, take Pittsburgh, for example. For 20 years, they used this system, and for two of those years, they were voted America's most livable city. And the problem is that it works. And when it works, you do get that healthier economy I was talking about. But that makes locations more valuable. That brings out the speculators, and so they go to the politicians and they get rid of the this tax system, and then things go back to where the square one.
So have you penciled it out? Do you know if we had this system in place, how many more taxes the state would gather, or would they gather more or less? Would it wash out and end up being an equal amount of money? Any sense for that?
It could be revenue neutral, and it just depends on what you set the rate at. And our legislation is politically sensitive, so it does try to be neutral. But theoretically and ideally, you would try to get all the value of all the nature and use, all the locations and resources that you could, and then create a dividend to return to people so that people would get an income apart from their labor and apart from their capital and feel good about it. They wouldn't feel like they don't deserve it, but they'd feel like, well, it's part of our natural heritage and all of us should benefit, sort of like in Alaska, where every resident gets an oil dividend.
503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. I am speaking with Jeff Strand and Jeff Smith. Both are from Common Ground, Oregon, Washington. Okay, well, let's kind of go through the proposals, and then we can, I guess, talk about whether or not what the shifts mean. So the first one we were talking about was the property tax shift. Is there more you would like to say about that, either of you, Jeffs?
The property tax shift category is just focused on that one item, the property taxes. So we have two other categories, basically, you can think of for our legislation. And another one that's involving a tax, an actual tax, would be the carbon tax. So those two things are on the tax side. The third category that I labeled land tax and dividend, that really isn't a tax proposal because the extra land tax that it proposes should actually be called a lease fee, because no money goes to government operating expenses. On the other hand, the property tax shift, which keeps property taxes, like Jeff said, neutral, and the carbon tax, those are actual tax proposals. So it may be getting into some semantics, but it's kind of important semantics because the proposal for this land tax and dividend doesn't have any money, like I said, that goes to government operating expenses. So it really should be more considered a lease fee.
So I'm confused. So if the taxes aren't going to go to the government to provide the services that they rely on, mm-hmm. then where does government get its money after that?
The Senate Joint Resolution 16, which is our land tax and dividend proposal, that's basically an overlay. It doesn't do anything to the tax structure as it exists right now. It's just an overlay that adds a land value lease fee from privately owned land that goes into a resident's dividend. So like the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, every legal resident of Oregon would get, if you use current land prices, would get $2,000 a year, including children. So that wouldn't go into the tax fund at all. It goes back directly to Oregon citizens, Oregon residents.
So to fund government, you would still have the existing taxes and the land tax separate from this land use fee. And when you talk about taxing land, most people think of their own land
right.
or farmland, but they don't think of downtown. And that can have like 1,000 times greater value per acre than outside of downtown, or even 2,000 times greater. And that land downtown typically is not owned by Oregonians. It's owned by outsiders. You remember the show Seinfeld and Lorraine? Yeah, she owns part of downtown Portland through her trust fund. And that's true of most American cities. The most valuable locations are owned by the richest people, and they can't be living everywhere. And so they tend to own these downtowns through these trust funds and corporations, and they siphon out of the locality a lot of the socially generated values of locations in that region.
So currently, if you purchase property, you have the option of purchasing property and the land that the property is on. How do you see property transfers happening if this system was in place?
It would be like in Hong Kong or Israel. In both those places, the land is public. It's not individually owned. And people can't tell any difference. If they live there, they think they own it. So what you do, basically, is you buy the building from the individual and you lease the land, the location, from your community. And it works out fine. The capital of Australia, Canberra, operates on the same system. The problem with those places is that there's no dividend. So when the value goes up, the speculators come out and they weaken the system. But if you had a dividend like Jeff Strang is talking about, then people would get back every increase in value of the land in their region. And then they wouldn't want to get rid of the system. They'd like to keep it and see land values go up. And every time they went up, their dividend would go up. Right now, every time the cost of land goes up, you get more homeless. You get more absentee ownership. You get more speculation. And none of that is good for society.
So let's talk a bit about the carbon tax proposal. So you have three separate proposals currently working their way through the legislative body. And most of your proposals are offering a study group or an opportunity for legislators to take a deeper look at what you're proposing, right? Mm-hmm. And so the third one that we haven't talked about yet, because I'm really intrigued by the land tax and dividend, because I'm just trying to figure out in my mind how that would work. Let's talk about the carbon tax.
Okay, so we have a Senate Bill 306, which studies the taxation of carbon and requires the State Department of Energy to convene a work group to investigate and recommend strategies for a carbon tax. So that is the study bill. And then we have two House bills that are not study bills. Those are actual statute bills that would impose a carbon tax.
And it looks like next week there's a possible legislative hearing on the carbon tax bill?
That's right, on the study bill, the Senate Bill 306.
I'd like to point out that Oregon, which prides itself on being cutting edge, is behind places like British Columbia, which already has a carbon tax. And they got that passed because they included with it a dividend, a rebate of some of that money raised by the tax coming back to the residents of British Columbia. And decades ago, I had a small hand in that when I was a guest at the Green Party up there, having been a co-founder of the Green Party down here a long time ago. And my contribution was to push the dividend part, because at the time, everybody was just going for a straight carbon tax, as they are down here right now. But I think it'd be more politically palatable if it had a dividend attached to it. We have some professors at PSU that did a study of the BC carbon tax to show that economically, it actually is beneficial. It attracts investment, creates jobs, and et cetera, et cetera. But politically, I think you have to have that dividend. And ethically, I think you have to have that dividend too, because some people, until we eliminate poverty, will be hit by such taxes.
That's what I was going to ask. Who will be the winners and losers in this proposals? You want to start with the property tax shift? So are we better off if we don't own our home and our land because the land belongs to the state?
Well, the way I like to think of the state land is that as a foundation, all the land in the state is under the jurisdiction of the state. So you can imagine all the roads, the public rights of way, and all the parks and other state land, that being the foundation land, and then the private land being parcels within that state land foundation. So, for example, you wouldn't really be able to have much commerce or transportation if you didn't have public rights of way. Mm-hmm. So it's the public land, the public rights of way, that connects all these private parcels of land. It's not the other way around. You don't have the state be one private parcel and then have little pieces of public land within that. You have the foundation of the public land and the rights of way that provides the channels for the people on the private land to communicate with each other and transport things between private parcels. So I think of the general state as being public land with the parcels of private land within that. And then what this property tax shift does is it shifts the tax, the property tax, off buildings and onto land, and it resets the private land assessed value to the market value. Right now we have an unnatural, artificial system where people pay property taxes based on this artificial assessed value that has no good relation to the market value. And we think that having a property tax based on the market value is important, but also having the property tax based on the land and not the buildings, so you tax private use of nature rather than improvements to the land, for example, building and improving structures.
Back to winners and losers for a second. There's two rules of thumb, and one is if you own land of average value or less, you catch a break, and if you own land of greater than average value, then your tax burden would go up. But there's another rule of thumb, and that is if you use land efficiently, you catch a break, and if you're just wasting it, then you pay more, which in a sense is a good thing, because if you have a whole lot of land, you're not using it all, you would relinquish part of that to the community, and that could become things like wildlife corridors if it's residential land, or if it's commercial land, it could become like sidewalk cafes and whatnot. So it would really tend to improve the use of land and make the city more livable, more walkable, less polluted, and so forth. But even if there is a burden, the dividend should take care of that. And if there's still a burden, we do have things like deferments, and we could pay people, if they could show a net loss, we could pay them bonds and things like that. The transition would be the challenge, but once it's in place, it would be hugely beneficial for a vast majority of people.
And so what's been the legislative reception that you've received so far?
Privately or publicly?
Both.
Well, one interesting thing is on the carbon tax. The Republican legislators tend to want to get away from that wording. So, for example, Senate Bill 306, that doesn't have the word carbon tax in it. It has, I think, something like energy saving incentive, wording like that, mm-hmm. rather than the word tax in it. But the Senate Bill 306 is actually a Republican senator's bill. So I think both sides are receptive to these ideas, and especially because Common Ground's overall orientation is away from taxing both capital and labor and towards taxing natural resources or land. So there's some good reception among the Republican legislators that we're proposing to lessen the taxes on capital as well as labor.
We have a caller on the line, so we're going to go to the phone line. If you'd like to join this conversation with Common Ground Oregon Washington, I'm talking with Jeff Strang. He's the chair of the Oregon Washington chapter, and Jeff Smith, who's the outreach director. Good morning, caller. Hello, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, hello. I forgot what I was going to say.
It happens to me all the time.
Maybe because I'm afraid to talk. I'm grateful that you folks are doing this work and are able to do this work. And you probably won't be able to answer my question. That will be all right. But, you know, I'm wondering about this work you're doing. You know, will it help in any way people like me who are stuck in low-income housing and can't get out of it because of terrible strong forces? In this country, and also at the same time, personally, I'm also living with people who don't like me, who want to evict me out of it. So I'm just wondering how, and if you can't answer, that's fine. I'm just so grateful you're doing this work. Goodbye.
Thanks, Joanne. Have a good day.
Well, one example I could use is the Senate Joint Resolution 16. Which is the land value lease fee that funds the dividend. And again, that dividend would be $2,000 per Oregon resident based on current land values. So if every Oregon resident got an extra $2,000 per year, that would help especially low-income renters demand better conditions in their rental properties. So the main break point there is whether you're using land efficiently or not. So, for example, if you're renting a 1 acre piece of land as a single person, that's not using land efficiently, so you'll be worse off at that point. But most renters and most low-income renters live in large apartment buildings and complexes that use land very efficiently. So the amount of additional land value lease fee that property would pay is a lot smaller than all the dividends that those tenants would be getting, including the children. So that particular proposal significantly helps low-income renters.
And what Jeff is saying is borne out by the experience of Alaska, which is the only state in which the income gap is shrinking thanks to the oil dividend that everybody gets. And outside of the U.S., there's the example of Singapore. And for all its faults, it does pay everybody a dividend. And, you know, the right wing always rates Singapore and Hong Kong as the best places to do business. And they are that. But they forget to point out that Singapore has a high land tax. Hong Kong, all the land is publicly owned. And that's why they are good for business, because they can keep other taxes down and collect the value of the locations. And it does so well, like I say, they have to pay a dividend to everybody, which really benefits mostly the people at the bottom.
Well, to me, it seems like if property owners are going to pay more in taxes, they're just going to send that to their customers, whether you are a renter, whether you are shopping at their store or whatever, right? They just pass the cost on. So I'm still not convinced that as a member of the community, as a homeowner mm-hmm. working in the community, that somehow this would be a better approach for me, because at least now And as horrible as our current tax system is, I can look at my property tax bill and know all the stuff I'm paying for, because I can see it. It's all listed out. It sounds like this system is more fluid. And so somebody's got to decide what's high-value land and what's low-value land and who's using the land good in a good way and who's not using the land in a good way. So that's the part that I'm kind of struggling with that. Would you help me with that?
Well, one of the problems here is we have a few different bills,
right,
a few different legislative measures. So it really depends on which one we're talking about. So if it's just about a property tax shift to land away from structures, it would change what people pay. Yes, it would do that. Some people would be more winners, and some people would be more losers, of course. But
so even the current system, we've got people who have almost identical homes, but depending upon what zip code they're in, they pay more or less property tax.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And so with this proposal...
Well, the idea is you want to shift the property taxes from valuing both buildings and land to just valuing land so that you encourage people to build out to whatever the zoning maximum is. So all private land, it's not free and clear for the owner to do whatever they want. It's all zoned. There's a government zoning category for each parcel of private property. So what this does is it encourages the private owners to invest more in their structures and their improvements to build out to that zoning maximum, which creates business and jobs.
And back to that issue of passing on this tax, we think that taxes can be passed on, and in general that's true. But this tax is somewhat different because what happens is the owners who are not using their land efficiently now have to. So they increase the land that's available for sale. They increase the building stock and so forth. And that greater supply actually brings down the price. So what you see happening in places that do shift the property tax is not that the owners can pass it on. Instead, some of them actually have to lower what they charge. And so in places like Pittsburgh, when they had this system, they had the highest rate of owner occupancy of any major city in the U.S., and because of that, the lowest crime rate by far.
And so does Pittsburgh still have this system in place?
Well, like I say, because it worked, it attracted the speculators, and they got the local city council to get rid of it, which is what happens in most places. Denmark had it, New Zealand had it, Australia had it, so that's been its fate.
503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. Hello, Jim. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
No offense intended, but it's coming across as a bit fuzzy. This sounds like a bureaucrat's dream and a landowner and taxpayer nightmare. Well, one thing, they're going to have to be implemented a good deal of regulations and personnel to decide whether the land is being used efficiently, and there's a lot of room here for entanglements, and also I can understand why Republicans would like this, because taking away from the drive to the impetus to have the corporations pay their fair share. I mean, this is taking a lot of steam out of that. And it's adding confusion to the general problem. Would you care to respond to that?
Thank you. Appreciate your call.
Well, again, we have the three categories of legislation, and it's kind of hard to just focus on one for this hour. But the Republicans are interested in especially the carbon tax proposals and the property tax shift proposals. And it doesn't, those two don't really change anything about the corporate property taxes. The property tax shift is actually easier to administer because if you're trying to assess land, it's a lot easier than trying to assess buildings. A lot of times the assessors don't go into the buildings and they don't see any improvements that were made to the interiors. And so the assessments of buildings are typically way off from what they actually should be. It's a lot easier for them to value land, and valuing land takes a lot less time than valuing buildings. All you have to basically know is where the land is and how big it is, and you can value it. So it would lead to less bureaucracy with the property tax shift to land. And it also does stimulate business, which is good for both labor and capital.
The caller, Jim, is right in that there's a lot of fuzziness, misunderstanding. But Jeff Strang is right, too. When New Zealand had this system, they could let go a lot of bureaucrats because it is much easier to assess land. And in America, yeah, it's the cradle of speculation. So there's even people on our side who oppose this. But if you go to England, you find the Green Party, because they got elected to the parliament, pushing this. The Guardian newspaper, you find George Monbiot, the regular columnist, promoting this. And elsewhere, back to New Zealand, when the speculators come out and try to get rid of it, ordinary people pack the meetings of the town council to defend the system. It's not a corporate dream. It's an ordinary people's beneficiary.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
I still have the feeling that somehow you've been making my point, but
well, I think that it's still early. I mean, since the legislation has been introduced and there's a hearing scheduled for the carbon tax bill on April 22nd, I just think that it's still early in the game, and this is a great opportunity, right, for the public to kind of get a opportunity to hear what's being proposed. And hopefully you, Jim, and others who are listening will start tracking it. And then, because I'm also trying to learn, which is why I appreciate both of the Jeffs being here today. So thank you for your call.
I always appreciate your graciousness. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And if I could put something in here about the third category, the land lease fee and dividend, the two other ones that we were talking about, those are study bills that have the best chance of passing, and that's valuable because it's important to get more information about the particulars on what those proposals would do. Now, the land lease fee and dividend one, that we know the particulars of a lot more because it's not a study bill. It's an actual proposal that would put a measure on the ballot for a constitutional change. And that can illustrate some good things with this, because the only people that would get a dividend are the legal residents. So corporations would not get a dividend. So you benefit the actual people. You don't benefit non-person corporations with the dividend. But it's up to the corporations to balance out the extra private land value lease fee with the commerce on the site. So it encourages the corporations to either use that land efficiently or to sell it to businesses or private individuals that do or would use the land efficiently.
Now, that's the part that I'm challenged by, because I don't know how you would force an individual landowner to sell their property or do something different to their property. I don't understand.
Okay,
how
well,
that would work.
Picture a vacant lot downtown that's just used for surface parking, like it's just completely vacant,
right?
And they just park cars on it,
right?
Well, if you put an additional land value lease fee of 4% of its value every year on that land, it's not going to pencil out for the revenue for the owners. It would encourage the owners economically to build a parking structure, maybe a four or six story parking structure, so they can pay, they can have more commerce to pay off that extra land value lease fee. So that extra land value lease fee encourages development to pay off that money.
Oh, we have other callers on the line, and we're going to go back to the phones. Hello, Annalisa. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
Good morning. Wow. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that one. And more parking structures downtown? Yuck. Anyway, how about the property taxes that churches don't pay? There are churches that have acres and acres of land that is only used maybe 2 days a week at the, and maybe 1 or 2 days for some other activities, and they have tax-free properties. How about some legislation on having them pay property taxes like everybody else does? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Again, we have three different categories, and the property tax shift would not affect that at all because churches, being nonprofits, are exempt from property taxes in the state. Now, the category of the land lease fee and dividend, that does have a provision for nonprofits to pay a land lease fee. So for privately owned land, it's got a 4% land value lease fee, and for nonprofit-owned land, it's got a 1% land lease fee, land value lease fee. So it does put in place some sort of public payment that would be required of nonprofits, but it's only a quarter of what would be required of privately owned land. So it does have nonprofits pay into this dividend system.
Most people might not realize it, but most taxes exempt more than they collect. So if you're not getting exempted, then you're paying for somebody else's exemption. I personally would close all loopholes, including churches. And if people are getting dividends, they can contribute their dividend to their church if so desired. But once you open the Pandora's box of loopholes, then it always benefits insiders. It doesn't really benefit the general public.
And so we were talking about this just before the program started. Every legislative session, at the beginning of the session, there's a tax expenditure book that is produced by the Oregon State Revenue Office. And what the book shows is all the tax breaks that are currently on the books. And as I said earlier, I used to go to that book at the beginning of every legislative session and highlight the Dirty Dozen, because some of the tax breaks, it's amazing to me how many people come out in support of the status quo. Because, well, that's our money. You can't take our money. Well, it's really not your money. It's actually the state's money. It's actually our money as the collective state. And we should fix this. And we still have taxes on the books for luxury boats. We still have taxes on the books for second homes. We still have a whole bunch of taxes on the books that we're paying actually corporations to follow the law, because environmental laws have shifted and changes and become more stringent. And so when we were innovative and paying them to do more than the federal law required, now we're paying them just basically to follow the law. And so as someone who understands some of our tax system, I would think that would be a great place to start, is to eliminate all those tax expenditures that no longer
serve the purpose that they were intended for. But then, you know, miraculously in this state, we found a way to get Nike, what, a special session and give them a, what, a 30-year tax break.
And that's the Democrats doing that.
And so, yeah, it's not Democrat or Republican. It's stupid politicians. We just heard that they were at the city of Portland in Multnomah County, and they're running around trying to figure out, is it $40 million or $60 million? It's like, why do we waste all this time giving bazillionaires tax breaks, and then the rest of us are struggling to fund the schools, to get our health care, et cetera, et cetera? So for me, I'm a little like, well, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that we have not had the political will to actually pick. And so that's my tirade. We have several callers on the line, but before I go back to the phone line, I want to tell our listeners what's coming up today on KBOO. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Pear speaks with former Reagan administration budget director David Stockman about his new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. That should be interesting. Yeah. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interview, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Robert Perry reports on Ronald Reagan's role and the destruction of hundreds of Native villages in the 1980s. And we'll remember the contributions of Sal Castro, who walked out with his Chicano students in the legendary action of 1968. At 11 on Between the Covers, Portland writer Monica Drake talks about her second novel, The Stud Book, an exploration of the complexities of what parenthood means today. And at 11 on Radio Zine, Sarah Sneath interviews Noah Husan about a bicycle trip through American communities that are DIY building a new culture of sustainability and sharing. Thank you all the KBOO members who renewed during our membership drive. If you missed that opportunity, feel free to go to kboo.org and click the tip jar and become a member that way. And we're going to go back to the phone line. We have Matt on the line. Good morning, Matt. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I have two questions about the land lease fee dividend. First, it seems like there is a potential that it could do some ecological harm. For example, I live on a piece of land that's in an ecologically sensitive area, and so I built the smallest possible structure I could. Are you saying under this new law that I should build the biggest structure I can so to avoid taxes? Because that seems like it could impact the environment that I'm living in. Also, it seems that that system could be inherently inefficient. Instead of allowing people to keep the money, you're having to pay for the administration to collect the money and then to distribute it, including postage and that kind of thing. And that kind of system of rebates tends to be very inefficient. How would you respond to those questions?
Thank you. Excellent questions.
Yeah, good questions. So if the land is in an ecologically sensitive area, then the zoning would not allow for building that is not sensitive to happen. So I congratulate you on maybe not building out to what would be allowed. But what is allowed is what we should be focused on. If it's an ecologically sensitive area, then we should have the zoning in place to protect that from insensitive development. So it's the same kind of argument that I've heard before from people, say, who own two lots side by side, and the one lot has a house on it and the other one is left alone and not developed for the property owner. Well, that undeveloped place is not using land efficiently. Somebody else, another family, could live in that place and not put pressure on the outlying natural areas as far as humans living on that. So we're trying to concentrate the development in the places where it already is, such as the central city areas and the places closer to the central cities to relieve pressure on the urban growth boundary, for example. And then as far as administration, it really wouldn't cost a lot. You're not really putting a lot into postage and that sort of thing. The way this is envisioned, the land value lease fee funding the dividend, is that the dividend would be dispersed with a charge card like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the food stamp program, which has a charge card.
You know, because we live in a fast-growing area, we tend to think that you can put up a building anywhere and it's going to make you money, but that's not the case. If you're going to put up a building, it has to be at a location where it can make you money. And most people are not familiar with the land value curve, but it's hugely steep in the center of cities. And those owners, they would be paying huge amounts of this fee. So they'd be the ones to attract any development. And there wouldn't be any left over to go to ecologically sensitive areas and suburbs and so forth. And it's not just theoretical. It is empirical. Places that have shifted their tax have attracted development to the center, have spared the suburbs, and so it does work environmentally. And so you see most Green parties endorsing this, promoting this. The Sierra Club Land Use Committee of the National Sierra Club endorsed it, and it takes a deeper look. But once you grasp it, then you're for it.
Well, we also know that Governor Kitzhaber has said that fixing our tax system is one of his priorities in his second term as governor. Have you had conversations with him? And if so, what's his position on your proposals?
Well, we contacted him early, and his staff said that we should be working in the legislature.
Okay, back to the phone line.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Thomas. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, good morning. A very interesting and stimulating discussion. And surely some good ideas. I too have some fears that there could be potential devils in the details. And I also, you know, like everyone else, has seen situations where if certain sweeping changes are made and there are elements that seem quite palatable or helpful to the general public, those are usually the first ones to be stripped away in the process of implementation. And my particular scenario of concern that comes to mind is, help me with this, is that, you know, I sort of envision, based on what I've heard, the potential for sort of a gentrification engine on steroids. Now, you know, if we're talking about the scenario of taxing property and not just based just on the land and so forth. Now, what about this? What about something like a scenario where there's fairly modest housing of established families or low-income folks? Maybe they've been there for generations and right now, and the property taxes have historically been, you know, maybe relatively low. And let's say apartment complexes, one- or two-story apartment complexes where, you know, maybe they're not the best apartments, but they're affordable and people can afford to live in an area. Well, all of a sudden, you know, gentrification begins, the property value, the land value begins to lift, and all of a sudden, what's going to happen with the pressure to someone to say, well, gee whiz, you know, who's going to be the one that's going to want to come in and say, gee, this land is more valuable, we can put more units, well, what's it going to be? Isn't it going to be the luxury loft builders that come in and try to attack build buildings and high density, and what's to guarantee that it's going to be affordable? So aren't we really, you know, seeing a potential? And also the thing is, let's think about small pieces of land with community gardens.
I'm laughing because you got a lot of thoughts that you're trying to get out simultaneously.
Yeah, that's it.
You raised some excellent points, and so I want to give both of the Jeffs an opportunity to respond. Thank you so much for your call.
You bet. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take the last example first. For community gardens, for example, near my house there's a double lot community garden, and it was donated by a woman who got a decent inheritance from her parents and donated the double lot to a nonprofit, the Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Land Trust. So, for example, the the land lease fee and dividend proposal would only charge that land 1%, and privately owned land, it would charge 4%. So the contributions of those of us who are members would easily pay for any land lease fee that would be charged for that nonprofit. And then if we're just talking about the property tax shift off buildings onto land, that owner being nonprofit would not have to pay property taxes under the current system. And then let's see, the other question about
gentrification.
About gentrification, right. The land lease fee, land value lease fee proposal, that would put more money in the pockets of low-income families, and that would help them to improve their dwellings, to not be taxed on any improvements that they would make for growing families and that sort of thing. Low-income families tend to have more members, and it puts more money in the pockets of those people, including half of children's dividends going into an Oregon College Savings Plan account for those children, which helps to equalize the opportunity for them.
Yeah, and we're not going to maintain poverty anymore. We're going to try to get rid of poverty. But look at places that do have the system or some variant of it, and you'll find that housing is more affordable, not less. And the reason being is that this land use fee or land tax doesn't just hit the areas that the caller described. It hits the whole city, the whole region. And so development is first attracted to the more valuable, more expensive locations. And the income of everybody goes up, not just from the dividend, but there's higher wages because there's more employment. So it benefits everybody. And also the community garden. You look at a city, and the cities with more open space have higher land value. And if the city is relying on land value for its tax base, it's going to want open space of the proper amount to increase the overall regional values. You don't lose gardens. You don't lose parks. You actually increase them in places where there weren't any.
We have a couple of callers. We're going to try to squeak in at least one more. Hello, Kenny. Can you be short, sweet, and to the point, please? We're running out of time.
Yeah, sure. I'll try. I just had a quick question. I might have missed this point, but let's just say for the average guy, maybe 3 acres of land, he has a small manufactured home, 3 bedrooms or something. Older manufactured home, and he's pretty much just living a self-sustained type of life out there, basically paycheck to paycheck, got his own garden where he feeds his family from and this and that. How's that going to affect him?
Thanks for the question.
Well, a property tax shift would put more burden on that person and that person's family. The land lease fee and dividend proposal, it depends on how many people are living there. For example, I know a 55-acre farm where they would balance out their land lease fee with the dividends that the 5 people living there would get. So that's basically a zero-sum balance. That's an equal balance. So where you have people paying the most is, for example, corporate-owned large farms, which don't have any people living there. So these proposals encourage more family farms where you're having more people living on the land and working it.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Jeff Strand, Chair of Common
Common Ground, Oregon, Washington, and I want to thank you, Jeff Smith, as the political director. Thank you both for being here. This is the beginning, not the end of a conversation. Thank you for your work. Thank you for bringing this to us, and we will continue to follow the legislative moves of your bills and continue the dialogue. I think what we've heard here today is people have a lot of questions, which we would expect people to have when you're talking about fundamentally shifting a system that people, though universally hate, at least understand what's in place. So thank you again for your time today. I am Joanne Hardesty. It has been my pleasure to be here with you today, and I will see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
There's a commonwealth that things should get a shot.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold.
Good morning from KBOO Portland. It is just about a minute now before 9 o'clock on Thursday morning, April 18th. A busy morning coming up at 9:30 on Fight the Empire. Host Per Fogering speaks with former Reagan administration budget director David Stockman about his new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Robert Perry reports on Ronald Reagan's role in the extermination of hundreds of Mayan villages in the 1980s. And we'll remember the contribution of Sal Castro, who walked out with his Chicano students in the legendary actions of 1968. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Portland writer Monica Drake about her second novel, The Stud Book, an exploration of the complexities of what parenthood means today. And at 11:30 on the radio zine, Sarah Sneath interviews Noah Husson about a bicycle trip through American communities that are a DIY building, a new culture of sustainability and sharing. That's all coming up, but up next, it's Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, and that is coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Ilahi Lecture Series on Wednesday, April 24th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Catherine Austin Fitz.
Managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services, Catherine Austin Fitz is also a publisher of the Solari Report. She served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner in the first Bush administration, and Managing Director of Wall Street firm Dillon Reed & Co., Inc. Fitz has designed and closed over 25 billion transactions and investments to date and has led portfolio investment strategy for $300 billion of financial assets and liabilities.
Catherine Austin Fitz will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 24th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Ilahi2013.
In observance of Earth Day, Monday, April 22nd, KBOO will present 12 hours of environmental news and public affairs programming from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. And then the sounds of human voices will stop. From 7 p.m. on, you will hear nothing but soundscapes from the natural world. A full 12 hours of radio with no voices or no human-made sounds whatsoever. So tune in to KABU for 24 hours of special Earth Day programming beginning at 7 a.m. on Monday, April the 22nd.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And it's also brought to you from a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, the first things I wanted to do is pass along a little of the news that is obscured by the marathon bombings, or should I say scarathon. This from Henry Nyman's, Dr. Henry Nyman's Recombinomics. There was a familial cluster of influenza discovered in Shanghai. A Minhang familial cluster, he calls it, first reported on March 7th. At the time, he writes, it was known that three family members had been admitted to the Fifth People's Hospital in the Minhang district of Shanghai, China,